School. Even before Job started elementary school, his mother had taught him how to read. This, however, led to some problems once he got to school. I was kind of bored for the first few years, so I occupied myself by getting into trouble. It also soon became clear that Jobs, by both nature and nurture, was not disposed to accept authority. I encountered authority on a different kind than I had ever encountered before, and I did not like it. And they really almost got me. They came close to really beating any curiosity out of me. His school, Montaloma Elementary, was a series of low-slung 1950s buildings 4 blocks from his house. He countered his boredom by playing pranks. I had a good friend named Rick Ferentino, and we'd get into all sorts of trouble, he recalled. Like we made little posters announcing, "Bring your pet to school day." It was crazy, with dogs chasing cats all over, and the teachers were beside themselves. Another time they convinced some kids to tell them the combination numbers for their bike locks. Then we went outside and switched all of the locks, and nobody could get their bikes. It took them until late that night to straighten things out. When he was in third grade, the pranks became a bit more dangerous. One time we set off an explosive under the chair of our teacher, Mrs. Thurman. We gave her a nervous twitch. Not surprisingly, he was sent home 2 or 3 times before he finished third grade. By then, however, his father had begun to treat him as special, and in his calm but firm manner, he made it clear that he expected the school to do the same. "Look, it's not his fault," Paul Jobs told the teachers, his son recalled. "If you can't keep him interested, it's your fault." His parents never punished him for his transgressions at school. "My father's father was an alcoholic and whipped him with a belt, but I'm not sure if I ever got spanked." Both of his parents, he added, knew the school was at fault for trying to make me memorize stupid stuff rather than stimulating me. He was already starting to show the admixture of sensitivity and insensitivity, bristliness and detachment, that would mark him for the rest of his life. When it came time for him to go into fourth grade, the school decided it was best to put Jobs and Ferentino into separate classes. The teacher for the advanced class was a spunky woman named Imogene Hill, known as Teddy, and she became, Jobs said, one of the saints of my life. After watching him for a couple of weeks, she figured that the best way to handle him was to bribe him. After school one day, she gave me this workbook with math problems in it, and she said, "I want you to take it home and do this." And I thought, "Are you nuts?" And then she pulled out one of these giant lollipops that seemed as big as the world, and she said, "When you're done with it, if you get it mostly right, I will give you this and $5. And I handed it back within 2 days. After a few months, he no longer required the bribes. I just wanted to learn and to please her. She reciprocated by getting him a hobby kit for grinding a lens and making a camera. I learned more from her than any other teacher, and if it hadn't been for her, I'm sure I would have gone to jail. It reinforced once again the idea that he was special. In my class, it was just me she cared about. She saw something in me. It was not merely intelligence that she saw. Years later, she liked to show off a picture of that year's class on Hawaii Day. Jobs had shown up without the suggested Hawaiian shirt, but in the picture, he is front and center wearing one. He had literally been able to talk the shirt off another kid's back. Near the end of the fourth grade, Mrs. Hill had Jobs tested. "I scored at the high school sophomore level," he recalled, now that it was clear, not only to himself and his parents, but also to his teachers, that he was intellectually special. The school made the remarkable proposal that he skip 2 grades and go right into 7th. It would be the easiest way to keep him challenged and stimulated. His parents decided, more sensibly, to have him skip only 1 grade. The transition was wrenching, He was a socially awkward loner who found himself with kids a year older. Worse yet, the sixth grade was in a different school, Crittenden Middle. It was only 8 blocks from Montaloma Elementary, but in many ways it was a world apart, located in a neighborhood filled with ethnic gangs. Fights were a daily occurrence, as were shakedowns in bathrooms, wrote the Silicon Valley journalist Michael S. Malone. Knives were regularly brought to school as a show of macho. Around the time that Jobs arrived, a group of students were jailed for a gang rape, and the bus of a neighboring school was destroyed after its team beat Crittenden's in a wrestling match. Jobs was often bullied, and in the middle of seventh grade, he gave his parents an ultimatum. "I insisted they put me in a different school," he recalled. Financially, this was a tough demand. His parents were barely making ends meet, but by this point there was little doubt that they would eventually bend to his will. "When they resisted, I told them I would just quit going to school if I had to go back to Crittenden." So they researched where the best schools were and scraped together every dime and bought a house for $21,000 in a nicer district. The move was only 3 miles to the south to a former apricot orchard in Los Altos that had been turned into a subdivision of cookie-cutter tract homes. Their house at 2066 Christ Drive was one story with 3 bedrooms and an all-important attached garage with a roll-down door facing the street. There, Paul Jobs could tinker with cars and his son with electronics. Its other significant attribute was that it was just over the line inside what was then the Cupertino Sunnyvale School District, one of the safest and best in the valley. "When I moved here, these corners were still orchards," Jobs pointed out as we walked in front of his old house. "The guy who lived right there taught me how to be a good organic gardener and to compost. He grew everything to perfection. I never had better food in my life. That's when I began to appreciate organic fruits and vegetables." Even though they were not fervent about their faith, Jobs' parents wanted him to have a religious upbringing. So they took him to the Lutheran church most Sundays. That came to an end when he was 13. In July 1968, Life magazine published a shocking cover showing a pair of starving children in Biafra. Jobs took it to Sunday school and confronted the church's pastor. "If I raise my finger, will God know which one I'm going to raise even before I do it?" The pastor answered, "Yes, God knows everything." Jobs then pulled out the Life cover and asked, "Well, does God know about this and what's going to happen to those children?" "Steve, I know you don't understand, but yes, God knows about that." Jobs announced that he didn't want to have anything to do with worshiping such a God, and he never went back to church. He did, however, spend years studying and trying to practice the tenets of Zen Buddhism. Reflecting years later on his spiritual feelings, he said that religion was at its best when it emphasized spiritual experiences rather than received dogma. "The juice goes out of Christianity when it becomes too based on faith rather than on living like Jesus or seeing the world as Jesus saw it," he told me. "I think different religions are different doors to the same house. Sometimes I think the house exists, and sometimes I don't. It's the great mystery." Paul Jobs was then working at Spectrophysics, a company in nearby Santa Clara that made lasers for electronics and medical products. As a machinist, he crafted the prototypes of products that the engineers were devising. His son was fascinated by the need for perfection. "Lasers require precision alignment," Jobs said. "The really sophisticated ones for airborne applications or medical had very precise features. They would tell my dad something like, 'This is what we want, and we want it out of one piece of metal so that the coefficients of expansion are all the same.' And he had to figure out how to do it. Most pieces had to be made from scratch, which meant that Paul had to create custom tools and dies. His son was impressed, but he rarely went to the machine shop. It would have been fun if he had gotten to teach me how to use a mill and lathe, but unfortunately I never went because I was more interested in electronics. One summer, Paul took Steve to Wisconsin to visit the family's dairy farm. Rural life did not appeal to Steve, but one image stuck with him. He saw a calf being born, and he was amazed when the tiny animal struggled up within minutes and began to walk. It was not something she had learned, but it was instead hardwired into her, he recalled. A human baby couldn't do that. I found it remarkable, even though no one else did. He put it in hardware-software terms. It was as if something in the animal's body and in its brain had been engineered to work together instantly rather than being learned. In ninth grade, Jobs went to Homestead High, which had a sprawling campus of two-story cinderblock buildings painted pink that served 2,000 students. It was designed by a famous prison architect, Jobs recalled. They wanted to make it indestructible. He had developed a love of walking, and he walked the 15 blocks to school by himself each day. He had few friends his own age, but he got to know some seniors who were immersed in the counterculture of the late 1960s. It was a time when the geek and hippie worlds were beginning to show some overlap. My friends were the really smart kids, he said. I was interested in math and science and electronics. They were too, and also into LSD and the whole counterculture trip. His pranks by then typically involved electronics. At one point, he wired his house with speakers, but since speakers can also be used as microphones, he built a control room in his closet where he could listen in on what was happening in other rooms. One night, when he had his headphones on and was listening in on his parents' bedroom, his father caught him and angrily demanded that he dismantle the system. He spent many evenings visiting the garage of Larry Lang, the engineer who lived down the street from his old house. Lang eventually gave Jobs the carbon microphone that had fascinated him, and he turned him on to Heath kits, those assemble-it-yourself kits for making ham radios and other electronic gear that were beloved by the soldering set back then. Heath kits came with all the boards and parts color-coded, but the manual also explained the theory of how it operated, Jobs recalled. It made you realize you could build and understand anything. Once you build a couple of radios, you'd see a TV in the catalog and say, I can build that as well, even if you didn't. I was very lucky, because when I was a kid, both my dad and the Heath kits made me believe I could build anything. Lang also got him into the Hewlett-Packard Explorers Club, a group of 15 or so students who met in the company cafeteria on Tuesday nights. They would get an engineer from one of the labs to come and talk about what he was working on, Jobs recalled. My dad would drive me there. I was in heaven. HP was a pioneer of light-emitting diodes, so we talked about what to do with them. Because his father now worked for a laser company, that topic particularly interested him. One night he cornered one of HP's laser engineers after a talk and got a tour of the holography lab. But the most lasting impression came from seeing the small computers the company was developing. I saw my first desktop computer there. It was called the 9100A, and it was a glorified calculator, but also really the first desktop computer. It was huge, maybe 40 pounds, but it was a beauty of a thing. I fell in love with it. The kids in the Explorers Club were encouraged to do projects, and Jobs decided to build a frequency counter, which measures the number of pulses per second in an electronic signal. He needed some parts that HP made, so he picked up the phone and called the CEO. Back then, people didn't have unlisted numbers, so I looked up Bill Hewlett in Palo Alto and called him at home. And he answered and chatted with me for 20 minutes. He got me the parts, but he also got me a job in the plant where they made frequency counters. Jobs worked there the summer after his freshman year at Homestead High. My dad would drive me in the morning and pick me up in the evening. His work mainly consisted of him just putting nuts and bolts on things on an assembly line. There was some resentment among his fellow line workers toward the pushy kid who had talked his way in by calling the CEO. I remember telling one of the supervisors, "I love this stuff. I love this stuff." And then I asked him what he liked to do best, and he said, "To fuck. To fuck." Jobs had an easier time ingratiating himself with the engineers who worked one floor above. They served donuts and coffee every morning at 10, so I'd go upstairs and hang out with them. Jobs liked to work. He also had a newspaper route. His father would drive him when it was raining, and during his sophomore year spent weekends and the summer as a stock clerk at a cavernous electronics store, Hall Tech. It was to electronics what his father's junkyards were to auto parts, a scavenger's paradise sprawling over an entire city block with new, used, salvaged, and surplus components crammed onto warrens of shelves, dumped unsorted into bins, and piled in an outdoor yard. Out in the back near the bay, they had a fenced-in area with things like Polaris submarine interiors that had been ripped and sold for salvage, he recalled. All the controls and buttons were right there. The colors were military greens and grays, but they had these switches and bulb covers of amber and red. There were these big old lever switches that when you flipped them, it was awesome, like you were blowing up Chicago. At the wooden counters up front, laden with thick catalogs and tattered binders, people would haggle for switches, resistors, capacitors, and sometimes the latest memory chips. His father used to do that for auto parts, and he succeeded because he knew the value of each better than the clerks. Jobs followed suit. He developed a knowledge of electronic parts that was honed by his love of negotiating and turning a profit. He would go to electronic flea markets, such as the San Jose swap meet, haggle for a used circuit board that contained some valuable chips or components, and then sell those to his manager at Hall Tech. Jobs was able to get his first car, with his father's help, when he was 15. It was a two-toned Nash Metropolitan that his father had fitted out with an MG engine. Jobs didn't really like it, but he did not want to tell his father that or miss out on the chance to have his own car. In retrospect, a Nash Metropolitan might seem like the most wickedly cool car, he later said, but at the time it was the most uncool car in the world. Still, it was a car, so that was great. Within a year, he had saved up enough from his various jobs that he could trade up to a red Fiat 850 coupe with an Abarth engine. My dad helped me buy and inspect it. The satisfaction of getting paid and saving up for something, that was very exciting. That same summer, between his sophomore and junior years at Homestead, Jobs began smoking marijuana. I got stoned for the first time that summer. I was 15 and then began using pot regularly. At one point, his father found some dope in his son's Fiat. "What's this?" he asked. Jobs coolly replied, "That's marijuana." It was one of the few times in his life that he faced his father's anger. "That was the only real fight I ever got in with my dad," he said. But his father again bent to his will. He wanted me to promise that I'd never use pot again, but I wouldn't promise. In fact, by his senior year, he was also dabbling in LSD and hash, as well as exploring the mind-bending effects of sleep deprivation. I was starting to get stoned a bit more. We would also drop acid occasionally, usually in fields or in cars. He also flowered intellectually during his last 2 years in high school and found himself at the intersection, as he had begun to see it, of those who were geekily immersed in electronics and those who were into literature and creative endeavors. I started to listen to music a whole lot, and I started to read more outside of just science and technology, Shakespeare, Plato. I loved King Lear. His other favorites included Moby Dick and the poems of Dylan Thomas. I asked him why he related to King Lear and Captain Ahab, two of the most willful and driven characters in literature, but he didn't respond to the connection I was making, so I let it drop. When I was a senior, I had this phenomenal AP English class. The teacher was this guy who looked like Ernest Hemingway. He took a bunch of us snowshoeing in Yosemite. One course that Jobs took would become part of Silicon Valley lore, the electronics class taught by John McCollum, a former Navy pilot who had a showman's flair for exciting his students with such tricks as firing up a Tesla coil. His little stockroom, to which he would lend the key to pet students, was crammed with transistors and other components he had scored. McCollum's classroom was in a shed-like building on the edge of the campus next to the parking lot. "This is where it was," Jobs recalled as he peered in the window. "And here, next door, is where the auto shop class used to be." The juxtaposition highlighted the shift from the interests of his father's generation. Mr. McCollum felt that electronics class was the new auto shop. McCollum believed in military discipline and respect for authority. Jobs didn't. His aversion to authority was something he no longer tried to hide, and he affected an attitude that combined wiry and weird intensity with aloof rebelliousness. McCollum later said, "He was usually off in a corner doing something on his own and really didn't want to have much of anything to do with either me or the rest of the class." He never trusted Jobs with a key to the stockroom. One day, Jobs needed a part that was not available, so he made a collect call to the manufacturer, Burroughs, in Detroit, and said he was designing a new product and wanted to test out the part. It arrived by air freight a few days later. When McCollum asked how he had gotten it, Jobs described, with defiant pride, the collect call and the tale he had told. "I was furious," McCollum said. "That was not the way I wanted my students to behave." Jobs' response was, "I don't have the money for the phone call. They've got plenty of money." Jobs took McCollum's class for only 1 year, rather than the 3 that it was offered. For one of his projects, he made a device with a photocell that would switch on a circuit when exposed to light, something any high school science student could have done. He was far more interested in playing with lasers, something he learned from his father. With a few friends, he created light shows for parties by bouncing lasers off mirrors on the speakers of his stereo system.